Even the father of the Constitution knew that a separation of powers wouldn't be enough to limit the power of the federal government. James Madison recognized that even with a good framework, government couldn't be trusted to follow the rules given to it. In Federalist No. 48, he wrote, "Will it be sufficient to mark with precision the boundaries of these departments in the constitution of the government and to trust to these parchment barriers against the encroaching spirit of power?" But experience assures us that the efficacy of the provision has been greatly overrated, and that some more adequate defense is indispensably necessary for the more feeble against the more powerful members of the government. Madison was saying that we need something outside the federal government to enforce the constitutional limits on federal power. Why? He referred to parchment barriers. Governments don't limit their own power, and documents simply can't enforce themselves. People often say they want a strong president who can get things done. But that's pretty much the exact opposite of what the Founding Fathers set up under the Constitution. Because of their experience with colonial governors and the king who ruled with almost complete and total authority, the founding generation was determined to limit the power of the executive branch. They certainly didn't want a president who could make law with the stroke of a pen. As Revolutionary War General John Sullivan put it, "I can by no means consent to lodging too much power in the hands of one person." So to ensure the president wouldn't rule over the United States like the colonial governors had done, the framers of the Constitution carefully separated legislative and executive powers. James Madison described this in a paper known as Helvidius No. 1. He wrote, "The natural province of the executive magistrate is to execute laws, as that of the legislature is to make laws. All his acts, therefore, properly executive, must presuppose the existence of the laws to be executed." Under the Constitution, the president was not meant to be all-powerful, and the founders set up the system to prevent such a thing from happening. Supporters of the monster state want you to believe the feds can do just about anything they want under the Commerce Clause. They couldn't be more wrong. The so-called Interstate Commerce Clause is found in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution. The founders explained that it authorizes the federal government to regulate the exchange of goods across state lines, along with some closely related activities, such as navigation and marine insurance. This included policies traditionally governed by the rules pertaining to merchants. Commerce did not include other economic or non-economic activities. But today, the courts, bureaucrats, and politicians have expanded the meaning of the word commerce and the clause itself to include any activity that merely affects economic activity. According to their view, growing 6 plants in your backyard is somehow considered interstate commerce. In the view of the Constitution, their position is totally absurd. Here's how James Madison described the Commerce Clause. "It was intended as a negative and preventative provision against injustice amongst the states themselves, rather than as a power to be used for the positive purposes of the general government." Simply put, under the Constitution, the Commerce Clause is not something that authorizes the federal government to regulate, control, or prohibit anything and everything they want. Everyone has the right to keep and bear arms. But it's totally wrong to refer to this as a constitutional right. The right to keep and bear arms is actually part of a broader, natural right to self-defense. No government, no document, no vote creates your right to self-defense. You have this right because you are a living, breathing human being. The Second Amendment doesn't create a right to keep and bear arms. What it does is prohibit the federal government from violating the natural right you already have. And that prohibition is absolute. A lot of people look to Thomas Jefferson or James Madison to understand nullification, but there's also George Nicholas. Early in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, approval of the Constitution was in doubt. Many delegates were concerned that the federal government would eventually take on additional, unwarranted powers. Leading historians often say the turning point in the convention was a speech by George Nicholas. He told the delegates to think of the legal basis of the Constitution like a contract entered into by 13 individuals. He then asked a rhetorical question. If one party agrees to the contract, but only under two conditions. One, that it would never be construed to impose any additional requirements. And two, any attempt to do so would be a violation of the contract. And if everyone agreed to those two conditions, wouldn't they be legally binding on all parties? The answer was self-evident. Yes, if that's the agreement, it would be binding on everybody. At that point, Nicholas voiced the obvious conclusion. In like manner, these conditions will be binding on Congress. They can exercise no power that is not expressly granted them. This makes up some of the foundational principles of nullification. If the feds attempt an unconstitutional act, a state doesn't have to comply, and it can even take measures to stop it from being enforced. Don't rely on a modern dictionary to understand the words of the Constitution. Like any legal document, the words of the Constitution have the same meaning today as they were understood to mean the day it was ratified. While some of those words mean the same thing today as they did back then, some of them are totally different than what you'd expect. For example, in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7 of the Constitution, Congress is delegated the power to establish post offices and post roads. Some people make the logical conclusion that a post road, in support of post offices, is any road over which the mail might travel, and because of that, they believe the federal government has either some or even final say over virtually every road in the country. But 18th century post roads were actually quite different. They were major thoroughfares built for speedy travel between distinct localities. They were different from lesser roads because they had stations which were called stages or posts that were used for hiring and changing horses. A modern version of this would be the interstate highway system. To the founding generation, city streets, crossroads, and other lesser highways, even if a courier might carry mail over them, were not post roads. There are many other examples like this, but the rule of thumb is this. If you use a dictionary to look up a word or phrase in the Constitution, make sure it was published around the time of ratification, or you'll likely end up thinking the feds have far more power than they're supposed to. The Constitution is quite clear on war power. The power to declare war is found in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the Constitution. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1 of the Constitution, on the other hand, refers to the President as the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. Taken together, this means that once war is declared by Congress, the President has the responsibility, as the Commander-in-Chief, to wage the war. Alexander Hamilton talked about this when he said that the President, while lacking the power to declare war, would have the direction of war when authorized. Preemptive strikes and undeclared offensive military expeditions are not powers delegated to the executive branch in the Constitution, and therefore are unconstitutional. Thomas Jefferson covered this quite eloquently when in 1801 he said that as president, he was unauthorized by the Constitution, without the sanction of Congress, to go beyond the line of defense. When acting without a congressional declaration of war, the president is authorized only to repel a military invasion or a sudden attack. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, James Madison explained why the Constitution divided war powers this way. He wrote, "The Constitution supposes what the history of all government demonstrates, that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it. It has accordingly, with studied care, vested the question of war in the legislature." There simply is no debate. Congress, not the president, decides if the country will go to war and when. One of the most maligned parts of the Constitution is the so-called General Welfare Clause. Rather than admitting they're in favor of violating the Constitution, supporters of various federal programs will often just twist the original meaning of constitutional clauses to fit what they want the government to do. The General Welfare Clause is in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 of the Constitution. It reads, "The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States." While some people like to claim that this means the federal government can tax and spend money on whatever it deems to fall under the general welfare, James Madison completely disagreed. In a 1792 letter to Edmund Pendleton, Madison explained the original legal meaning of the clause. He wrote, "If Congress can do whatever in their discretion can be done by money and will promote the general welfare, the government is no longer a limited one possessing enumerated powers, but an indefinite one subject to particular exceptions." It is to be remarked that the phrase out of which this doctrine is elaborated is copied from the old Articles of Confederation, where it was always understood as nothing more than a general caption to the specified powers, and it is a fact that it was preferred in the new instrument for that very reason as less liable than any other to misconstruction. In other words, the federal government may provide for the general welfare, but it must do so within the scope of the powers delegated to it in the Constitution. While the Supreme Court has often gotten things wrong on the Constitution, Joseph Story's opinion in Prigg v. Pennsylvania has never been overturned. In fact, it has been reaffirmed by the court in a number of cases spanning more than 150 years. He wrote, "The states cannot be compelled to enforce the Fugitive Slave Clause, and it might well be deemed an unconstitutional exercise of the power of interpretation to insist that the states are bound to provide means to carry into effect the duties of the national government, nowhere delegated or entrusted to them by the Constitution." This has helped cement James Madison's advice as a legitimate and essential part of the constitutional system. These days, there are two popular definitions for the word constitutional, and they're both wrong. But there's a third, far more important one, and we'll talk about all three next. Some people seem to think that the word constitutional means the same as the word good. When they support a government program, they tend to get angry if you refer to it as unconstitutional. I'm not sure why, but maybe they hold the Constitution in high regard and don't want to be confronted with the fact that they're in favor of violating it. Other people believe that what is constitutional is whatever the Supreme Court says is constitutional. Until it changes its mind, of course. They often say things like, "The Supreme Court has already decided this issue, it's over. Time for you to move on." Basically, these people are in favor of a dangerous form of government, not too different than what exists in Iran. Finally, there are some of us who know what the word constitutional really means. We reject the notion of a living, breathing constitution. We recognize that the legal meaning of the Constitution today is exactly the same as the moment the words were ratified and given legal force. And we know that meaning is what defines the word constitutional, even if the federal courts happen to disagree. Whether it's background checks, or so-called laws passed in 1934 or 1968, every federal gun control measure is unconstitutional and should be rejected, resisted, and nullified. People often say they want a strong president who can get things done. But that's pretty much opposite of what the founding fathers set up under the Constitution. Before the American Revolution, colonial governors ruled with almost total authority. They had absolute veto power over legislatures and the authority to issue edicts that carried the force of law. They could create law with the stroke of a pen. It was basically the colonial version of executive orders, as they're so often used today. When the people declared independence and states began drafting their own constitutions, they vowed to end this kind of power. In a nutshell, the founding generation believed that only a radical destruction of that kind of authority in one person could prevent the resurgence of total power throughout the country. This carried over into the drafting of the Constitution. The royal governors represented the executive branch that the founders were most familiar with. Their experience with those guys was the reason they were determined to strictly limit presidential power. In fact, when famed founding-era legal expert St. George Tucker explained executive authority in his commentary on the Constitution, he wrote that we shouldn't even talk in terms of presidential powers, but we should more properly call them duties. James Madison also clearly defined the limited nature of presidential authority in an essay known as Helvidius No. 1. He wrote, "The natural province of the executive magistrate is to execute laws, as that of the legislature is to make laws. All his acts, therefore, properly executive, must presuppose the existence of the laws to be executed." Today, this wisdom has been flipped on its head. Where the founders rejected sweeping executive power, many Americans today embrace, and more dangerously, they often beg for it. Under the Constitution, the president was delegated the authority to execute laws passed by Congress, not create them with the stroke of a pen. Under the Constitution, the delegated power to regulate commerce among the several states does not include a power to mandate commerce or prohibit it. Did you know that federal land is only mentioned in two places in the Constitution? We'll discuss what those are next. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution is the Enclave Clause. It empowers the federal government to establish a national capital and, with the consent of a state, land areas known as enclaves. These are areas where much of the territory is titled to private parties, like in Washington, D.C. The key point is that this land is under federal rather than state jurisdiction. Enclaves can only be held for enumerated purposes, and the state where it's established must consent to its creation. According to constitutional scholar Rob Nadelson, enclaves are supposed to be very limited in size and scope, and the founders would not have approved most current federal land holdings as enclaves today. Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2 of the Constitution is the Property Clause. Here, the federal government is delegated power to dispose of property. along with the power to regulate land it holds. The feds retain complete control over territories, but once states are formed, the federal government has a duty to dispose of land. Again, even under the Property Clause, land can only be held and used for enumerated purposes. Here's the short version. There is no power under the Constitution for the feds to obtain and retain land for whatever they want. Like the Supremacy Clause, they're only authorized to exercise power when done in pursuance of other delegated powers in the Constitution. My name is Michael Bolden, reporting for the 10th Amendment Center. Thank you so much for watching. The 10th Amendment is what's known as a rule of construction. This is a legal phrase the framers were quite familiar with. It's basically a set of instructions on how to read the entire Constitution. To understand this, first, let's review the text of the 10th. The power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. As a rule of construction, we're told two primary things. One, the federal government is only authorized to exercise those powers delegated to it in the Constitution, and nothing more. Two, if something isn't delegated to the federal government and isn't expressly prohibited to the states, then the people of each state get to determine whether or not they want to deal with something and how. Thomas Jefferson called this the foundation of the Constitution. And if you apply these two rules to anything and everything done or proposed to be done by the federal government, your foundation will be strong.
Welcome to 10th or Tuesday. This is episode number 21. My name is Michael Bolden. I'm here with Mike Meharry.
Greetings.
Today is day 194 that the GOP has failed to get rid of Obamacare, but we're not going to focus on this particular failure. We've got another issue that has been hovering over our heads like a black cloud, that is asset forfeiture and a new memo or directive from Jeff Sessions. Mike, before we get into an explanation of asset forfeiture and the various programs, give us a very quick overview of what that memo. Is it a memo or a directive from Sessions?
So Sessions initially made some comments that he wanted to ramp up asset forfeiture, and then the DOJ issued a directive. So essentially telling how his wishes should be put into effect. And okay. Essentially what he's said is that he wants the Department of Justice to go full bore into accepting state asset forfeiture cases, even in states where they have stricter asset forfeiture laws, which require conviction. So, okay. But basically, it's going to allow the feds to take those cases, proceed with them even without a conviction, even in states where they require a conviction. So it's going to allow them to circumvent more strict state laws and go full bore with forfeiture.
And like, it's bad all around. Now, John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute, who we publish a number of his articles, he does a weekly column. His report on this basically started out with, hey, let's not mince words. Jeff Sessions wouldn't know the Constitution if it smacked him in the head. I think he does. I think he's a power-hungry problem that we're facing, and this asset forfeiture issue is extremely serious. So let's explain to people what's going on. First of all, a quick overview. What is asset forfeiture, Mike?
Asset forfeiture, in a nutshell, is when cops take your stuff. Instead of arresting you and charging you with a crime, they take your money, they take your car, they take your house, they keep it, whether you're convicted or not, sometimes without even charging you. It's a way to punish you. It's typically used for drug crimes. So it's a way for police to effectively circumvent the more difficult process of getting a criminal conviction and punishing people for even being accused of having drugs by taking their stuff. The really ugly side of this is it's a great cash cow for police departments. Yeah. They generally get to keep a great deal of the money. In some states, they keep 100% of what they seize. So it's a policing for profit. It incentivizes this type of policing. It f- focuses resources on forfeiture instead of actually solving violent crimes such as rapes and murders and things now, that actually
Mike,
have to do with
public. We're talking big numbers. Some people will poo-poo this idea like, oh, okay, they're going after drug dealers. Why do we want to offend drug dealers? But I've seen some statistics in various states where the average forfeiture is around $1,000, and it's coming from a lot of just everyday people. They're not going against crime syndicates. The majority is small numbers, individual people, but they're doing it a lot. They're taking people's stuff without conviction. I'm pretty confident that there isn't a single founding father that wanted to create a system where there would be a government taking your stuff without a conviction. No due process whatsoever. Charging your dollar bill or your car with a crime, and then it's still guilty until proven innocent. So this is totally backwards. Now, asset forfeiture is one thing, and this happens on the state level, and it also happens on the federal level, but it also happens in a partnership, too. So sometimes states will restrict it, and then sometimes, well, the feds never seem to. They just do whatever. But a vast majority of the law enforcement actions in the country happen on a state and a local level, not the federal issue. So there's this program called Equitable Sharing. I know we've covered it a few times. We've got a few videos on the site about this and a number of articles, but give the kind of brief rundown of what the Equitable Sharing program is, Mike.
So equitable sharing happens when the federal government, federal law enforcement agencies partner with the state or local law enforcement agency. The federal government actually prosecutes the forfeiture. So the state and the feds, they work together. They get the stuff. It goes into the federal court system. The forfeiture process goes through the federal process, not the state process. And then once it's all said and done, the federal government sends up to 80% of the proceeds back to the state and local law enforcement. So the feds do all the work and the money goes back to the state and local law enforcement agency. Where this really becomes a problem is that state and local police can do the forfeiture and then simply pass the case to the feds in what they call an adoption. Once the feds adopt it, it goes through the federal process, even if the feds weren't involved in the actual seizure itself. So it allows the federal government to process the forfeiture, and then it allows the state and local police to cash in on the process.
And where this is come out in a really nasty way are places here, like here in California, where the state itself a few years ago had some very strong restrictions on this asset. Surprising, of all places, California, had one of the best state level laws on the use of asset forfeiture for local law enforcement here or state law enforcement. And so what they did, what the police department started doing, as soon as this was passed, they just started claiming that almost every case they were involved in were a federal case. So they would go and do a bust or a raid or something like that. And because they weren't allowed to under state law take all the property, they would just call up the local FBI office and say, oh, hey, we've got a federal case on blah, blah, blah. And as soon as it becomes a federal case, it goes into the federal equitable sharing program. They claim it's a federal seizure, even though the locals are doing almost all the work and doing everything. And then the feds send the cash back. Luckily, we got a vast majority of that shut down here in California and a few other states. A lot of organizations have been working on this, but it is extremely dangerous because it's an end run that the feds are promoting this and pushing this, even though some states are restricting it.
Exactly. And that brings us back around to this directive that Jeff Sessions issued a few years ago when Holder was the attorney general. He actually he actually did curtail this adoption to some degree. Didn't end it completely, but he did curtail it. And it made it more difficult for state and local police to pass off the cases to the federal government. This new directive by Sessions, it takes away all restraint. It takes away all barriers. He's basically saying, we want you to go full bore with this adoption. We want you to get as many cases from the states as we can. And it's absolutely, the purpose of it is to end around these state laws, because we are beginning to see a number of states. I believe there's 13 states that now require a criminal conviction. So this is an intentional action by the federal government to circumvent state law and allow police to continue to take people's stuff without a conviction. I can't think of anything that's
more horrible. It turns local law enforcement into federal law enforcement agents. Yeah. It's centralizing police. The last thing that anyone should want is a national police force on every single issue. in every single community. It is extremely dangerous. Now, let's quick go over this timeline. So back in, was it late 2015 or even before that, Holder's DOJ put some restrictions on the, is it on the equitable sharing program?
It was on the process of adoption.
So it
limited adoption, exactly. Okay. Limited those transfers to issues of public safety. And of course, that could be broadly interpreted. Yeah. But
so
it
probably
limit
wasn't
it, to some
it wasn't heavily limited. But let's say, what would you guess if it was 1 to 10, 10 it's completely limited, 1 none. We'll give it a 1 to 10.
Let's say it's a 5.
So something significant. There was a cutback on the program. Then I'm pretty sure it was late 2015, maybe December. Yeah. There were all these news reports that said, the Holder ended the asset forfeiture program. But that was false, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, at the time, it was a budget restraint, and they suspended all equitable sharing programs. So basically, the state and local police
the payments,
weren't getting
though.
The money. Yeah, they weren't getting their money.
Okay.
They said, we have no money. You're not getting the money. So obviously, that would take away the incentive for state and local police to pursue it through the federal system.
I do recall a lot of bad news reporting on that, where they were basically saying Holder ended a federal asset forfeiture program. That was absolute
bull. That's not what happened.
A few months later, who was the AG at that point? Was it Lynch? I can't remember.
Remember if it was. It was somewhere in it could have. There was a transition in there, so I don't remember which one it was. But basically, they found the money.
Yeah.
So
a few months later,
they
reinstated that sharing of the cash, and the money started flowing back. But the moderate restrictions stayed in place, and so they've been there. But the program is still happening. They're still using equitable sharing. It's just not, I don't know, $100 billion worth. Maybe it's less than that.
Well, and it's also important to note that that those Holder restrictions only applied to this adoption. It didn't restrict at all federal state partnerships. So when you have these task forces and these joint enforcement efforts, that didn't stop that at all. So that was still going on.
It only slowed down if it started as a local thing and then they decided, hey, no, we want to make this we want to make this a federal one. Okay, so less than half by far, but some we'll take some restrictions on these bad practices, certainly. Okay, and then so then last week, is that right? With Jeff Sessions?
It was last week or two weeks ago. Yeah.
Okay. So then Jeff Sessions comes out, the dinosaur that he is on the Constitution, and especially on the drug war and civil rights and just standard liberty. The guy is awful. So he wants to take the very moderate, the pretending to be the good guy, Eric Holder, actions, and he throws those even in the trash.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
If he was going to do anything with them, he should trash them and say, this isn't even close to enough. We need to shut this program down, if he was a constitutionalist, which he is not.
No.
So go over once again what Jeff Sessions is doing.
So Jeff Sessions is saying, federal government, we want you to go full bore with adoption. We want you to adopt as many cases from the states as you possibly can and circumvent these state laws, circumvent the more difficult process. And he's looking at it and he's saying, hey, states are cracking down. They're making it a little bit harder to do asset forfeiture. Federal government, we want you to overrun that. We want you to make we love asset forfeiture here at the federal government. That's Sessions' position.
Yeah, and really, I can't let go of the idea that this is really creating a nationwide police force. Because if the state law enforcement is okay, let's say Los Angeles Police Department is acting as Los Angeles Police Department, enforcing all kinds of bad Los Angeles municipal code that shouldn't exist, but they're doing it locally. Well, the effect of that program is really only affecting us poor souls who've made the choice to live where we do here in LA.
Right.
But as soon as they start passing this stuff along, that's why it was such a big deal here in California, and they start partnering with the feds, then they become basically they're acting as agents for the federal government.
Right.
They're no longer local law enforcement. They're federal agents because they're basically looking to enforce as much federal law as possible. And Mike, you and I are pretty straightforward on this. Most federal law shouldn't even exist.
Well, exactly. And let's look at it from a practical standpoint. In a state like California, where marijuana is now completely legal,
right?
Well, now the state, a law enforcement officer could conceivably go and seize assets from somebody who has perfectly legal state marijuana, perfectly legal in the state. He could seize assets from that person, call up the FBI and say, hey, FBI, we've got this federal drug case here. This guy had weed, which is illegal in the federal under federal law. So now we're going to do asset forfeiture. The guy never broke a state law. The state police shouldn't be enforcing this. LA police shouldn't be enforcing this at all. But now they have a way that they can enforce drug laws, even though it's legal in the state, by being, as you say, federal police. They're enforcing federal law instead of state and local law.
Yeah, the national police is a thing. I mean, let's go right to it. It's of the Third Reich. We don't want Stasi in this country, although it exists. I mean, there are lines, but they're very much blurred with programs like this. And so Sessions is going full bore. He loves this program. He's a product of the era where, man, I don't get it. I don't get how people. It doesn't make any sense. How anyone can be in favor of this. No matter what you think of the guy on other programs, this is a program that I think is so contrary to the entire system that the founders set up. It is acting without due process. It is people don't have a right to defend themselves. It's charging property with a crime, in essence. And then it's totally destroying the idea of the 10th Amendment and federalism by getting involved in stuff that should just be local issues. So it's really problematic. Now, Mike, in the last few minutes that we have here, the positive thing. So this is all pretty negative stuff. The positive thing, however, is something that we've been talking about for quite a long time. I mean, in the past few years, I'm glad we really got involved in this issue in the last few years. But give us the rundown of how states can actually put an end to this.
So it's actually really easy. All you have to do at the state level is prohibit your state and local law enforcement officers from participating in this adoption. Don't let them pass these cases off to the federal government. And we have seen that in a number of states, New Mexico, Arizona,
Nebraska. California.
Yeah, in California. So they've passed asset forfeiture reform, and they've included or added to that asset forfeiture reform very simple language that prohibits the transfer of cases from the federal government to from the state to the federal government. And every state needs to do this.
Well, a good example, I think, is New Hampshire, where the previous session, maybe it was 2 years ago, they restricted asset forfeiture on the state level. But they knew all along, and we had been in touch with some of the activists involved there, that you know, if they don't address the federal issue, there's going to be a problem. So I had heard from people through email, like, look, we're going to do this step by step. So currently there's a bill that is being held over until 2018, HB 614, that only addresses the federal equitable sharing program. Basically, what we're talking about is opting out from this federal program. They don't have to participate in it. And if you shut that down, and in most states, it's not fully shut down there. At least they're shutting it down for basically all the average people. People, you know, if we're talking about an average of $1,000 or $5,000, they're shutting it down under $50 or under $100,000. So it's still going to happen on the big guys. Not that they shouldn't have rights as well, but this is a way that you're going to get more public support and take steps forward.
Yeah, it's a way. Allowing the partnerships to go above a certain level is a way of kind of throwing a bone to law enforcement, who will fiercely lobby against any type of asset forfeiture reform. So we've got some states like Iowa and Connecticut that did pass asset forfeiture reform during this session, but they did not close that loophole. So folks in those states will definitely want to make sure that their legislatures take the next step and address that loophole. We call it the loophole. The loophole needs to be closed in every situation. And again, it's not a complicated it's basically two paragraphs.
Just opt out. Don't participate. The article that you wrote, just to close out here, it's states can thwart new DOJ asset forfeiture policy. Mike, I think you did a really good job covering basically what was happening in the recent past and what Jeff Sessions is trying to push through right now and what can be done about it. So we'll have links to that in the show notes. So when you see it on the archives on the site, and of course, if you support this kind of work, make sure you go to 10thamendmentcenter.com/members so we can continue getting this information out there and doing the activism that is necessary to get this type of legislation passed to nullify these types of unconstitutional federal programs. Of course, thank you so much for watching, and we'll see you next time here at 10th or Tuesday.